dancing with the symphony's swing band. For tickets, visit lakegenevaorchestra.org.
This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be about things such as the Communications Decency Act, social media, censorship, and some privacy issues that just seem to be just beyond belief. So let's get started with what in the heck is the Communications Decency Act? This is what is called Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act of 1996. It was actually one of the most valuable tools for protecting freedom of expression and innovation that's ever been done on the internet by the US government. And what this was really about was the liability waiver of things like internet service providers, blog posters, or really anybody that had the ability to allow users, so people other than those in the employ of their company, to post content and even just simply comments on their platform. So this would apply to Google, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So these companies, Twitter, Pinterest, these companies are all being protected under what's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And what it specifically says is no user or no provider or user of an interactive computer service, so interactive computer service meaning that somebody other than your company employees can modify the content that's posted there. So no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So this also meant that online intermediaries could host or republish speech that, and they are protected against a range of laws that might otherwise be used to hold them legally responsible for what others say and do. So the protected intermediaries include not only regular internet service providers, but all these interactive computer service providers like I described. So there are important exemptions to the Section 230, such as certain criminal and intellectual property-based claims, but the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, created a broad spectrum of protection that has allowed innovation and free speech to exist online and to flourish. So this allowed users to create their own videos and upload that content to, you know, YouTube, Vimeo, Amazon, Yelp, Craigslist, you name it. So while it would be illegal, for example, to solicit minors for sex acts on Craigslist, Craigslist could not be held criminally liable for the postings of a Craigslist user. Now, as part of this protection, these providers of these services have sometimes selectively decided to police the content in accordance to what they call their end user agreement and terms of service, meaning if you're going to use their service, then you're going to be subject to those terms of service. So this is where the rub comes in, that should they be looking for content that is explicitly and clearly illegal? Yes, they should be. And at the very least, they should be referring those issues to law enforcement. So what they also should be doing is if something is just clearly illegal, such as I said, solicitation of underage minors for sex acts. That would clearly be illegal. So in that case, they should pull that content, and then most likely they should also inform law enforcement. But it then comes down to this extremely gray area, which is where the abuse comes into effect, which is this matter of applying their own terms and service as they, you know, terms and conditions of their service as they see fit. And this has recently in the last, really explosively in the last 4 years, but obviously before that as well. Probably this all started back in the year 2000 or so, but it's really ramped up to an exponential level now in the last two to four years. And what's happening is that these providers of these interactive systems, such as Facebook, Google, YouTube, Vimeo, Twitter, they are doing things such as allowing criminal behavior, criminal speech. Again, I'm talking about things like child pornography and pedophilia, things like that. They're allowing that content, realizing that they're under the protection of CDA 230. So they are allowing that content to exist on their platform. But yet at the same time, they are selectively removing accounts of people that are not engaging in anything illegal, but who clearly have a different political viewpoint and a different ideology than what the majority of the people at this social media platform or this interactive platform hold. Now, it's well known what the political belief system is of the vast majority of people that are hired to work at these companies. The problem is that these are not really private companies anymore. As soon as they became protected by the liability waivers provided by CDA 230, then they became a platform for free speech where, due to the government protection, the government elimination of their liability of the content that was posted on their platforms, then it was a public-private partnership, and the First Amendment does apply. So the problem is they are engaging in what is called, they're basically violating the First Amendment constitutional rights of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Americans. And they're doing this just simply because these people have accounts on their platforms that have a different political opinion than they do. And it's not appropriate, and it's a big problem. Well, on the positive side to this, there is a congressman who has put in a bill, Congressman Louis Gohmert, who has introduced a bill to remove those liability protections of those social media companies, because those social media companies have been proven irrefutably over a long period of time, meaning it's a systemic, intentional pattern. And even Google's internal memos and internal meetings have been leaked that absolutely prove irrefutably, and this is true also with Twitter, that they are intentionally filtering. So what they're doing is using algorithms to hide, promote, and filter user content, and they are being very discriminatory, meaning that, oh, let's say somebody with a certain political belief complains to them that they don't like the content that somebody is posting, then they've been known to just shut down these accounts permanently. On the other hand, people may actually get death threats against them, and the people who are making the death threats do not get their accounts shut down. So making death threats against somebody is a crime. So again, this is a prime example of how these social media platforms, these interactive platforms, are not acting in a way that is consistent with the special legal protections that they've been given by the Congress of the United States. These companies are supposed to be unbiased platforms. And that is, you know, that's part of what an internet service provider is also supposed to do. If you can afford to pay for the service, to pay to connect up to the service, then you're supposed to be able to have a connection to the internet that is not filtered. You know, they're not throttling you and they're not filtering it. And that's true with the majority of content. There is some of that, but at least it's not a filtering problem. The real abuse that's been happening is coming out of the social media platforms. You know, Google, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Vimeo, Pinterest. This even goes so far as to remove people's accounts simply because they don't believe that vaccines are a healthy or effective medical option. Now, again, there's nothing criminal about having a personal opinion that you don't believe in vaccines, and yet there are many, many people who that have had their accounts on these social media platforms just simply terminated due to their belief system. And this actually ends up being in accordance with a UN directive that has been issued that says that anyone who is deemed to be a vaccine denier, their goal is to have these people deplatformed. And that's really the terminology that is used, is the deplatforming. And, you know, I really, frankly, don't understand why anybody would even have an account like Facebook at this point, or Netflix, because Facebook has been having just an endless stream of egregious abuses of privacy. I mean, first and foremost, their entire platform is all about making money off of your personally identifiable information and your profile of your behaviors and patterns and likes. And Mark Zuckerberg himself actually testified in front of Congress stating that the users and their data and their profiles are the product that Facebook uses to make money. So, I mean, they admit it. There's nothing hidden about it. What is hidden is that they claim that their service is secure or private. Well, as of last month, it became very widely known and exposed that there have been even more egregious security and privacy violations at Facebook. And what happened in December is it became published that Facebook had actually allowed Microsoft's Bing search engine. Okay, you know how Google has their Google search engine? Well, Microsoft has a search engine called Bing. And Facebook allowed the Bing search engine to see the names of virtually all Facebook users' friends without their consent. So this means that the Bing search engine was able to index that content on the back end through some level of privileged access on a system-wide basis. And Netflix and Spotify were given the ability to read and delete Facebook users' private messages. Furthermore, Royal Bank of Canada was given the ability to read, write, and delete users' private messages and to see all participants on a thread. And this was also true with Facebook allowing Spotify and Netflix to do that too. And I mean, these are privileges that are far, far, far beyond any sort of privilege required for those companies to integrate Facebook into their systems. Now, from a how do you deal with this problem, there are a lot of these companies that are trying to get to a centralized identity. So they're trying to make it so that you could log into different things with your Facebook identity, or you could log into different things with your Google account, your Gmail account. What happens in that process is a handoff, and that handoff is where that, when you're trying to authenticate to something, it then passes off that authentication request to whoever that other provider is, whether they're passing it off to Facebook servers or Google servers, etc. And there has to be some level of an information exchange that goes on in order to make this happen. And really, I don't trust any of these companies at all whatsoever to be doing that process correctly, to where not only is that secure, but the handoffs are not resulting in excess data leakage. And of course, my concerns are completely founded by the reality of what was exposed in a New York Times article about this topic. So it gets worse, actually, because Facebook's own records show that Yandex, which is a Russian search engine, and China's Huawei, I hope you've heard of Huawei now, which is basically the largest networking company in China, who is a wholly owned subsidiary of the communist government over there. And both China's Huawei and the Russian search engine giant Yandex were given by Facebook access to unique user IDs even after Facebook had stopped sharing them with other applications under the guise of being concerned about privacy risks. So what this ended up resulting in was there were some identities of Ukrainian dissidents who became known to the Russian government. And well, let's just say some bad things happened to them because this user data became exposed. You know, people are using social networking to try to securely and privately interact, and that is clearly a mistake to take that approach. These companies are not secure, they're not private, and in order for them to have penetration into markets such as Russia, Iran, China, they are entering into agreements with those governments. And when your data, when you are a Facebook user and Facebook has entered into an information sharing agreement with the Chinese government, then they also have access to your data as a United States citizen. Now, this also means that whoever the Chinese and Russian intelligence agencies wish to share that information with also has that data. You know, I mean, you just have to take this to the logical conclusion where it's going to go. So if you, I mean, there are other implications associated with this one identity concept that I've talked about before. If you have this single identity, so let's say you have this Facebook identity, and you now tie this Facebook identity to many other services because it's convenient for you. You only have to remember the password for Facebook, and then, you know, you can use your Facebook login in order to be authenticated to these other sites. Well, there's another reason to not do that, which is that if your Facebook identity gets compromised, and you had all of these linked assets to where your Facebook credentials would unlock access into those resources. Well, then all the rest of those resources have also just become compromised. So I'm absolutely vehemently against increasing your risk profile by using a single account to access a bunch of different resources. You know, unless they're all resources that are related inside the same asset. You know, and that is not the case when you use a Facebook identity to log into other platforms. So the one identity concept makes sense to the extent that you're using a single, highly secured, multi-factor authenticated identity to access all of the resources by that particular provider. So that's okay. But then you have to be using passwords that are at least 16 characters long, complex passwords. And I'll reiterate something I've said at least 1,000 times, which is that you have to limit the risk of exposure of passwords through this process of using unique passwords. And there really should be no challenge in using unique passwords anymore, because there are just a plethora of quality free password management applications out there. Now, I want to share with you something that is very enlightening from the perspective that it's a real world example that happened to somebody. And, you know, it's always valuable to learn from the experiences of others. So what happened in the last week is that there's a very small business we work with that had declined to use multi-factor authentication on their email system, though we had strongly recommended it. Well, so what ended up happening was that due to no multi-factor authentication being on this one user's account, which of course was a high-profile user, it's too much of the time high-profile, high-value users, typically owners of businesses, do not want to be inconvenienced by having additional security measures. And the reality is that they are a bigger fish to catch than other people, so they should actually have more security and more stringent authentication requirements than other users. Well, anyway, so this was one of those high-profile users who had declined multi-factor authentication due to the inconvenience aspect. And they happened to be browsing a Chinese website. And then shortly thereafter, they started to have problems associated with people were emailing them back saying that they couldn't open the Dropbox files that this person had sent them. Well, this person hadn't sent anybody any Dropbox files. So what had really happened was that they visited a Chinese website. The Chinese website executed code on the computer. That code secretly and surreptitiously stole the cached credentials for the Outlook application, and then utilized those to do a remote authentication attempt into the email system, which inside of that, then they granted themselves additional rights to that user account, which thankfully was not an administrator account, which is one of the reasons why email-enabled users should never, ever, ever be admins. So then the hackers put in certain rules into the email mailbox, which took any new email that came in and put it in the deleted items. And so they were able to basically send out about 500 spam messages with this account before the email system itself detected that there was this malicious activity going on, and it just literally disabled the account. So fortunately, again, that end user account was not an admin. Because otherwise, it would have been game over and it's toast. It's toast time at that point. Absolute toast time. And they contacted us, and we immediately disabled all connections to that account, changed the password, and then had a conversation with them about how this account must have multi-factor authentication. I don't care how inconvenient you think it is, you have to have it. So we did all of that and then proceeded to effectively do a security audit of that account, pulling audit records for what had been done. And fortunately, we had previously turned on audit logging a long time ago when the system was originally set up. So those audit logs are not on by default, but that is part of our standard setup. So we were able to trace back the activity that had been done and eliminate these forwarding rules and eliminate access and trace and track all authentication sessions. And there haven't been any issues since then with that account. So I share this experience with you to tell you that, you know, first and foremost, if your IT security people are telling you that it would be really, really wise to do such a thing, especially if that thing doesn't cost you any more money, then you should really do it. You know, like if multi-factor authentication is part of the existing system, then you should really, really use that functionality because it doesn't cost you anything more to use it. And believe me when I tell you that the inconvenience of having to re-authenticate once every, you know, certain number of days, 20 to 30 days, to tell the system that you are who you are, and in the meantime, you're also protecting any new attempts to communicate, any new attempts to authenticate to your cloud resources. That inconvenience of slightly slowing down your authentication on an occasional basis is nothing in terms of the inconvenience of having your system compromised. So the cleanup of that whole mess, so the response and cleanup of that whole mess was 5 hours of labor. So just think about whatever the labor rate is that you pay for consulting services. Also think about whether or not you even have access to somebody that has the capabilities of effectively doing an investigation and cleanup on such a situation. More often than not, that's a lot harder to actually find a qualified person or a qualified company than you'd think. I mean, just think for a moment how much difficulty you might have finding a good plumber or a good electrician or a good, you know, building contractor. You don't get to just, you know, dial up the phone book and find somebody who's awesome. So that's why doing things on a proactive basis, such as having better security, using these free multi-factor authentication options. And when I say free, they are either just outright free or they are included in whatever it is that you're already paying for. So if you choose to not use it at that point in time and then you have an issue, then you're just incredibly foolish. And I'll leave you with one final note, which is that it still seems to be an issue where people think that their user accounts should be admin accounts to cloud resources. And I went through another experience this past week where one of our clients just decided to give their credentials to a third party. Had that person had admin access to the cloud account, then that third party would have gone in and made unauthorized changes. So this isn't exclusively a matter of whether or not you should have those types of access. It's a matter of also whoever does actually have admin access to the systems, they also have to have a very deep level of understanding about how and where those credentials should be used and that they should never be disclosed and that they're very disciplined about where they use those credentials. Well, that's it for today's show, and I hope you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by